technology can be a blessing, it can be a frustration as well. We have several calls, individuals calling in. Those on the telephone, please identify themselves.
Mary Beth, Bobo Ferguson.
Mary Beth Ferguson. Okay, anyone else on the telephone? Because we have several new members of the advisory committee, why don't we start with the handsome gentleman down to this end and just tell us who you are?
I'm a guest. I'm Paul Merrill.
Paul Merrill?
Yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Nick Dunn. I work for Councilman Newton, Sullivan County.
Welcome.
And I'm Ryan Stolten, and I'm the Deputy Director for the Department.
Thank you.
Trustee Martina, and I'm a Researcher at the CWA.
Joe Westlery, Manager of the Southern
Department. Amy Fisher Newton from the Salt Lake County Council.
Bill Krim with United Way of Salt Lake.
Jennifer Godfrey with Utah Community Action.
Jennifer, one of our new ones. Why don't you just take 1 minute and tell us one thing about you that we don't know?
Sure. So I am the CEO and Head Start Director for Utah Community Action. I've been with the agency a little over 18 years, and I am also a licensed clinical counselor, and so my heart and soul is truly in the work that we do every day.
Thank you and welcome.
Thank you.
Doug Goldsmith, Chair of Resilient Utah.
Douglas?
Tracy Gruber, Department of Workforce Services.
David Britton, Chair of the Advisory Committee.
I'm Casey Cameron with Workforce Services.
Steve Clemens, Pastor of Zion Evangelical Lutheran Church.
Steve, you're one of our new ones as well. Mm-hmm. Tell us one good thing about you.
I'm a Cubs fan.
which
means I know humility and receive all of you as gifts.
Well said.
Thank you. We hope you have a great day for the season this year.
Ben Gibbs, BYU Sociology Department.
Jill
Walsh-McDonald,
Department of Health.
Liz Riley, Department of
Workforce
Services.
Greg Harris, Department of
Workforce Services. Welcome all. We'll get started by giving a little brief explanation on the minutes. You'll remember that our last meeting was a joint meeting with the Commission. And the Commission has met once since that last meeting and has approved the minutes. But also our bylaws require this committee to approve the minutes, so I would hope that someone would come forth with a motion to approve the minutes of the meeting of November 14th. That seems like an eternity ago, but of 2018.
So moved.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
Hearing a second, further discussion? We'll call for the motion. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? You may ask they approve and go forward. I think that we had a brief introduction from Reverend Clems and from Jennifer. Dr. Davis. Just announced Dr. Neil Davis is also approved at the last commission meeting to be a new member of our advisory council, and hopefully he'll be here before our meeting is over. That being said, we will turn the time to Jeremias Solari for the discussion relative to the forthcoming 2019 annual report. Jeremias?
Oh, yeah, so I want to first provide some context into the new direction that we're going to force for the 2019.
You better explain the new direction.
Yeah, I will.
Okay.
So first, the context. So in the past reports, we've done a tremendous amount of descriptive statistics, which are really great at pinpointing perhaps a problem. You know, if we're looking at a statistic such as graduation rates, for instance, or GDP, and so on, we can see that there's a difference, therefore maybe there's a problem. But what descriptive statistics are not good at is giving us a good understanding of the interplay between variables that are maybe causing IGP, for example. And so the new direction that we're taking in the 2019 report is to do more of a causal correlation study analysis of IGP and these variables of interest that we have collected. So, the new, like I said, the new report is pivoting away from this to describe the statistics towards these more rigorous methodologically analyses that we'll be presenting. And it really moves away from looking at IGP like we've done as a cohort longitudinally, but more about the concept of IGP in a longitudinal perspective. So there's a bit of a difference that is quite key for us to be able to make a decision on how we're going to deal with IGP in the future or how we improve on it. So having said that, the annual report, the 2019 annual report, will be broken into three major parts. Part one will be an executive summary, introduction of the information, and then we will be providing still the descriptive statistics that we've been providing on a yearly basis for the 2019 cohorts. So that's part one. That will give you a current state of the IGP as a group. Part two will be the Department of Workforce Services WRA reports, or Workforce Research and Analysis report, where this is where we're going to be looking at the causal relationship between variables of interest and IGP as a concept. So Kelsey is the principal researcher who is leading that research. And then we'll have, you have a question?
No, go ahead. Okay. Please, thank you.
And then we have also the partner reports, which would be instructive for the partners who are providing data to us for IGP to also conduct analysis of the 2013 cohort through time and to be able to look at specific metrics that is mission sensitive to them, right? So for instance, for higher education or for some of these other partners that we have. And for them to send us their analysis of how the 2013 cohort has performed across time, longitudinally, in relation to them being IGP in comparison to a reference. So. And part three will be the commission report and concluding remarks. So those three parts put together construct the 2019 annual report that will be provided. At that time of October. Is that correct? October, is that what it is?
Yeah. October 1st.
Yeah, October 1st.
So give us the timelines in terms of preparation so everybody knows what obligation or what kind of guidelines or guideposts that will be present. When will we need to be involved with this committee and some kind of preliminary reviews or anything of that nature? Tell us your critical dates.
Yeah, certainly. So I think we're targeting the middle of July internally to complete our portions and also the partner reports. So I'll probably say that at that point in time, we'll probably, I'll try to make sure we'll engage the committee here and extend options to review the report or provide feedback to the report. We'll incorporate those feedback or that review and then have a final publishing in October. Tracy, you can correct me if I'm wrong in that timeline.
That's right. It's a similar timeline to in the past. We'll get the analysis back from the departments by, I hope, by mid-July. The research subcommittee has met with the research with all the agencies that are part of that subcommittee. So they know that their causal analysis has to be by the middle of July. The descriptive statistics that we always report on, we will already be that work is already happening with the agency. That's been happening for 5 or 6 years, so that piece of it is pretty well set. So I would expect that we're going to start getting the analysis back on that piece from the department probably by May. That's usually when we get it back. So the editing process will be from mid-July until, you know, mid-August, I would say, towards the end of August. And then we take time with the Department of Workforce Services within our communications department to make the report visually appealing and easier to digest. So,
questions for Jeremiah relative to the production of the reports? I think individual partners have already had some briefing on the timelines and so on. So that should go. Ben?
I don't know much about the report, but I just have, I'm just concerned about the word causal. And I'm sure you've had some internal discussions about it, but causal might unfairly suggest causal ordering when you have correlational analyses. And so I'm just curious, is there any kind of causal analysis like randomized control trial, instrumental variables, regression discontinuity that would fit the causal language?
So I think it's a causal correlated variables correlation. So all the work that we've done is correlation.
Okay.
So right. I would have a hard time saying this cause X caused Y, right?
My only concern is that language could filter out into policy in ways that we don't know if X is causing Y or Y is causing X, and could lead to a lot of unfounded confidence. When I think we want to be held to a correlational standard, which then leaves room for interpretation in either direction.
Yeah, thanks so much for that feedback.
Yeah, no problem. By the way, I write all my research papers with causal language, and then when I submit it to the publisher, I change it all to associational. It's just, it's so much more persuasive to think causally and theoretically to
right.
think causally, but ultimately it could do some harm.
Yeah, I agree.
Further questions, Jeremiah, or any observations, or if anyone would like to render relative to that process, always a big item in our annual agenda, so we'll be spending a lot of time relative to that process, and once it's received, we will be, of course, thinking about what kind of legislation might be proposed after we see the report, if any. So, Jeremiah, any other observations you'd like to make? Anything else? Okay, thank you. Very much. I guess there are two questions that we need to kind of think about as an advisory committee. How would we like to be involved once the report is released? Would you care to be involved in the process of analyzing it to the point where we would then be a party to some proposed legislation with the partners involved? As an example, I would hope that we would think about that very seriously, because I think it's our role as an advisory committee to help the individual legislators understand what the issues are in the report and hopefully prepare legislation that can solve some of those issues. Unless I hear something different, that we will plan on being involved in that process once the report is released. Always flowing out of that report are a series of recommendations that this advisory committee, because of its width and breadth, would like to make to the full commission. So once the report is prepared and we have a chance to analyze it, I'm guessing we will have a joint meeting again with the commission members and there propose whatever observations or issues that we might find germane to process. So we'll go forward with the understanding that we'll be involved at least in that extent. Tracy, Casey, any other involved committee that we need to think about? Okay, we have a couple of issues that center around the families experiencing IGP. One of those is the Next Generation Freedom Fund. Tracy, are you ready?
Oh, he is not. Are they okay? He was going to go at 10:45, but if they're ready.
It's just me today.
Who is it?
D also. But let me go ahead and introduce everything.
Okay, well, I just want to
you to introduce me?
I will.
Okay.
So,
hey, everybody. By the way, I'm on the phone here, so go ahead, Paul.
Okay. This is preface before I introduce Dee and talk about the research. First of all, it's nice to see everybody. I've worn my best T-shirt today, so I just want you to know that I'm stepping my game up. But a couple years ago, we were dealing with the counties and helping them establish their local strategic plans. I had the privilege to facilitate a few of those. And during the course of that facilitation, a lot of things just kind of hit me differently. I thought, ultimately, we don't know really who we're talking about. We don't know our customer. And I know that's a strong statement. A lot of work over the years has already happened. But I thought, maybe we can dig down a little deeper. And so I finally scrounged up the money that it cost to do this study. And to me, the results were profound. I don't know that the results were anything I didn't really expect. For me, during those county facilitation meetings, I realized that that most of the real deep issues with these children living in IGP were more non-cognitive than cognitive. So in other words, if you want to increase graduation rates, trying to just give them tutors or making sure they attend isn't going to work. That their issues of trauma, trump any kind of mechanical, cognitive things that we could do to really help them. So in other words, just getting them into the seat of school isn't going to be enough. The second thing is that I learned from this research is they are different. The culture is different. And we're not sure whether they can fit into current processes and succeed like even other struggling children might succeed within the current system. So I hired D. Alsop with Heart and Mind Strategies, and I'm going to introduce him now, and then he's going to walk us through this. I have known D. since BYU days, so that's 40 years ago, and in several capacities throughout my career, I've hired his firm, which was first Worthland Worldwide, and now Heart and Mind Strategies, and probably four or five times to do this kind of value-based research. Dee is not a stranger to Utah. He's lived here a long time, and has been involved in all sorts of government and community efforts. He was on the Governor's Quality Growth Commission when he lived here. He's done this kind of research on education, air quality, and healthcare in Utah. He's worked with Envision Utah for 20 years now. So with that, do you have the PowerPoint in front of you?
I do, Paul.
Okay.
And I assume all the members there either have it up on a screen or have copies in front of them?
Yeah, it's all on the screen, and it's just starting with the cover page.
Thank you. And first, I want to thank all of you for what you do on this advisory committee. Appreciate the work that you put in to contribute to this issue. And also just thank you for having me share what we've learned with you. Our hope here is that we'll be able to share a few additional pieces to what is, quite honestly, is a fairly complex problem without easy solutions. And we're going to share you some things, some of, like Paul said, or things that we kind of felt like we might find, but there's some others here that were very different than what I had anticipated that I do think give some insight to this audience. And we weren't necessarily looking for specific policy solutions as much as better understanding these families, from a perspective that we have not seen reflected in other research. I'll get into that, but also get into more specifically some particular approaches that involve mentors and the role of mentors might play in the lives of the youth. So let's go ahead and jump into it. Yeah.
I just want to mention, too, and I know you'll talk a little bit about the methodology, but this wasn't just Utah. This is a multi-state survey that included Utah.
That's correct. So if you go to page 2, I'll describe a little bit about the project that we're working on. There were two phases. The first phase is a phase in which we went into quite a dip qualitatively with these families. And what's unusual about the way we went into this, often you'll do focus groups where you'll talk to people, bring them in and talk to them. In this particular case, we used a platform that allows people to convene online interactively with their laptops so they can communicate and talk to each other, but also over the phone. And that eliminates a lot of the personality and the social dynamics that would happen in the focus groups. But in addition, in the first phase, this first round of qualitative research, we talked to parents and separately talked to the children of those parents in intergenerational poverty. And that's the perspective that you don't often see taken in research, where you're getting the two perspectives of the parent and the child living in the same home and how they view some of these issues. And this first phase of research was done entirely in Utah and in the state of Georgia, which was the other place where we had a major sponsor involved at the Georgia Center for Opportunity, who's focusing on this issue in a lot of depth. And so all this work for the first phase was done in Utah and in Georgia. And then for the second phase, we kind of took what we learned, the hypotheses that we built, and formed them into more structured questions that could be applied in a more larger scientific representative sample that was done nationally. And that's largely what we'll be sharing with you today is the results of that national study. And I'll add one other dimension to this. If you go to page 3, there's some real specifics about the types of samples and everything. I'm not going to get into that too much. But as we got into the national study of intergenerational poverty parents and teens, we were seeing things that made me really curious to wonder, well, I wonder what normal teens would think about this and how they would respond. Is this characteristic or uncharacteristic? And so we launched an additional study of just regular American teens, age 13 to 17, on a few topics so we could see if what we were finding was unusual, high or low in terms of the attitudes, and I think there's some really interesting things that we found there. So before I jump into what we're finding, I wanted to see if there was any questions about the methodology or the approach that we use.
Any questions? Yes, sir.
This, Ben Gibbs, BYU. What was the response rate, participation? How did you recruit?
So the recruitment for the online portion was done through online panels. And I'm not sure how much you do that kind of research, but there's a lot of different sources that we use. Primarily, though, they were recruited against criteria of people who were on one of the several different types of public assistance programs and have been generationally involved in that way. And I don't know the exact response rate for that, and because it's kind of an online panel, those response rates are kind of different than you would get from a purely random digitizing type of approach that you might have been asking about.
Thank you.
Further questions up to this point? Okay, let's proceed.
Okay, so go to page 4 if you would. And these are the 4 things that we're going to be sharing. We looked into a lot of other things, just description of their homes, the activities, behaviors in their home. But for the sake of time, we're going to focus today on 4 things. And the first one is that these families, parents and youth, don't see anything wrong or bad about their current situation. That is what their life is, and as far as they're concerned, that's That's a great life. It's a good life. Secondly, teens in this situation, particularly these IGP teens, live a what is almost a self-isolating type of life. They like to stay at home, and they like to be at home around folks who kind of understand their situation, and therefore has real implications about the more limited type of view that they have about the way life could be. The third point that we found is that in their eyes, we asked a number of different questions about being self-sufficient. And in the eyes of the IGP population, there's not a lot of value or priority about being self-sufficient. It's not an essential criteria for their happiness or what they feel it needs is essential for a good life. And then fourth, we found very good strong evidence that mentors are, in fact, an important priority for teens, as seen by the parents, not as much by the teens. And the fact parents feel like their teens are getting good mentors, but if you look a little bit more closely, those mentors are really family members. And therefore, they're not getting that kind of broader help outside that circle that kind of shares their situation and life views. So those are kind of the four key points we'll get into, and I want to jump now into some of the data that kind of makes these points that I've just shared with you. And if you go with me to page 6. This is a question that we asked fairly early on in our interview. What do you feel you or your family would need? Oh, excuse me. How much do you agree or disagree with the following statement? My family is on a solid footing. We have what we need, and everyone and everything is doing okay. And we know that the folks we're talking to are on a number of public assistance programs. And we know other things about what's going on in their lives on a daily or weekly basis. But regardless of that, you've got nearly 60% of them who are saying that they agree that they're on a solid footing and that everyone and everything is doing okay. And it's a little bit better amongst the youngest IGB teens, but overall, it's pretty consistent whether you're a parent or a child. Most feel like they're in a good situation. Only 1 in 4 feel like they're not on a solid footing. And what's interesting is if you kind of look over on the right side of page 6, we looked at this same question amongst those who live in certain types of situations. For example, those who live in homes where the utilities have been turned off. And about half of these people have lived in a home or are living in a home where the utilities have been turned off. And you're still seeing about 55% of those parents feel like everything's going okay. And the same thing with teens. They're accustomed to the situation they are, and it's not unreasonable for them to feel like that's normal and that's okay. You see good evidence of that. Same type of thing, even those who are living in homes, and there aren't a lot of these youth that we talk to, but in parents, there's about 4 or 5% who live in homes where there's abuse going on at least once a week. Even in those homes, you're getting over 50% of them who think things are okay in terms of their family situation. Let's go ahead and skip to page 7. And this is just an overall rating of their situation in life. And it's a 1 to 10 point scale where 10 means everything is as good as it can be, and 1 means things are as bad as they can be, is how that scale ranges. And on average, for IGP parents, they're rating their overall situation in life on a 1 to 10 point scale of 6.4. You've got about a third of them who are putting themselves in the top 3, 8, 9, or 10, the top 3 box, which means a pretty good life. And that's even higher when you look at it amongst these IGP teens. Nearly 40% who are thinking that overall they're living a pretty good life. What's interesting is if you go to page 8, this is one of the things that we didn't anticipate, is if you look at teens in general and how they rate their overall situation in life, teens in general, those that are not in intergenerational poverty situations, actually are not actually rate their overall situation in life a little bit lower than teens who are in an IGP situation. And in fact, I didn't share this, put this slide in the deck, but I did want to describe it to you. We asked another question about how happy you are in your life. And we found that IGP teens, there's 87% of them who say they're very happy or pretty happy, compared to just 75% of all other teens in America. And in fact, amongst those who are IGP who say they're very happy, it's 1 in 5, 22%. Whereas as all American teens, there's only 13% who say that they're very happy. And so a major question that comes up, and kind of my hypothesis is that American teens in general face a lot of stress, and they face a world with high expectations and high, you know, views of what they ought to be doing with their life. Whereas is one possible hypothesis is that the IGP teens aren't feeling the same level of stress and feeling greater happiness overall in situations that they have in living in intergenerational poverty. Another kind of evidence of this, if you go to page 9, thinking about where your parents are in life, how satisfied would you be to grow up and be in a similar situation to where your parents are now? And you see that, in fact, IGP teens, about 1 in 3 would be satisfied to growing up and be in a situation with their parents, and another 43 would be neither satisfied or just satisfied, they'd be okay with it. And only 1 in 4 would be dissatisfied growing up to be in that situation. It's a little bit higher satisfied with growing up to be like their parents amongst the younger teens rather than the older teens. But overall, there's at least 1 in 3 would be very satisfied growing up into that situation. If you look at American teens, that number is a little bit lower compared to... the number would be dissatisfied is a bit higher amongst all teens. That's about 32%. So let's move to another kind of area we looked in on page 10, this idea that the teen years are isolating and they like to stay close to home. And they have a limited view. If you go to page 11, here's kind of the data that that's set up. These are different types of situations. And we asked these teens and their parents to describe which ones agreed to their own situation or describe their own situation. And you can see that IGP teens in general, they say that their friends really understand their challenges, about 53% of them, a little more than half. But that means that there's nearly half that say that their friends don't understand their challenges. What's most interesting is at the bottom of these different situations we asked them about, where you have 60% of IGP teens who are saying or agreeing that sometimes it's easier to spend time alone or with family because they really get the challenges in my life. And that is a pretty telling thing in terms of there's a bit of a self-isolating that goes on. Nearly 60% of them are agreeing with that. It's easier to spend time alone or with their family because those are the ones who kind of get the challenges that are being faced in their life. And it's also interesting that you've got about 1 in 4 who are also saying that they have difficulty making friends. And then if you go with me to page 12, we asked parents and teens living in intergenerational poverty about a variety of different types of factors that impact how successful somebody can be in their life. And we ask them to indicate the degree to which they think that's an important factor of success. And the scores that you're seeing on this chart are the percent who gave that a score of an 8, 9, or 10 on a 1 to 10 scale. And you can and see, in fact, that a lot of the factors like getting married to a good partner, avoiding a victim mentality, being supported by mentors, you're getting the majority of the people agreeing that those are important factors for success. But what's interesting is that there's, you know, for every 70 or 68% that you have on there, that means that there's 30 to 32% who are not putting that as a high priority or important success factor on such things like having a good marriage partner, going to college, getting a good job, etc. And what's interesting as well is if you look at about fourth from the bottom of all these items, not the public assistance, how important that is to that to success. You have only half of the parents who are saying that being off for public assistance is an important indicator of success or determinant of success. It's interesting the youth put that as a more important criteria for success. But even another way of looking at that, if you look at the very bottom, qualifying for public assistance programs, you have one in five IGP parents, one in four IGP parents who put that as an important criteria for success in their life. So the very defining of success in life for a quarter of IGP parents is qualifying for public assistance, which makes perfect sense given the situation and context in which they are living. And I'm going to jump to page 19, which kind of looks at some other success attributes, but looks at them in a different way. So if you could move ahead to slide 19, I'll come back to the other slides in a minute, but I just want to make 2 points. What you see here now, again, are success factors, and along the horizontal dimension is how important that parents and teens place these items. And what you see on the vertical dimension is how challenging it is to accomplish or to make that happen. And with one exception, the teens place higher importance on all of these success criteria. The one exception being in the bottom right, bottom left corner, qualifying for public assistance. And that's what I mentioned before. Teens don't see that as nearly as an important factor for success as parents. And then the other thing is that the parents all see all of these items as more challenging than the teens do in terms of the ability to accomplish these. And so, with age, maturity, and the difficulty that they've had in finding good jobs and avoiding drugs, having a strong work ethic and things like that, they are placing those as a higher level of challenge in accomplishing them. So just a couple of things about those I wanted you to see there in terms of those success factors. Now, if you would, if you go back to page 13, there's just a few more slides I wanted to get through, but this page 13, I think, tells an important story about the situation that these families live in. And these are just the frequency of different types of activities. You're getting about three quarters who are having family dinner about once a week, or time with their families, with their parents for games and movies. Those are fairly common. But also, things that are not uncommon, tobacco use, alcohol consumption is 32%, which is a frequent occurrence, marijuana use, 23% frequent use, 20% fights and physical activity, hard drug use, 14%, serious types of abuse, 12%. And those are factors that I think that you are aware of from other data, and just something that this research that we did also reaffirms. Also, interestingly, the teens are less likely to report some of these types of things like marijuana use and alcohol, and fights, and drug use, and other types of personal abuse than their parents are reporting it. But if the parents are reporting it, you can probably rest assured that, in fact, those are then in the home, even though the teens aren't admitting to it or reporting it. You jump with me to slide or page 15. Make a couple of points here, and then we'll kind of wrap this up. We mentioned this. We indicate that different people see issues differently, and then which of the following do you feel best describes your own feeling? One, that self-sufficiently means you don't rely on other people You can be self-sufficient and receive aid from the government. That's one option. Or self-sufficiency means you rely on yourself and nothing else. Receiving aid from the government means you aren't completely self-sufficient. You've got 40% of parents and teens who believe that self-sufficiency includes receiving aid and qualifying for aid and meeting the requirements for aid. And in their minds, that makes perfect sense. It's just kind of different than what folks who aren't in that situation might look at those things and how they might review that. Page 16 is another kind of view at this, about whether or not self-sufficiency means that you take advice from others. And interestingly, in this kind of way of looking at self-sufficiency, you've got 43% of the teens and parents who means that if you're self-sufficient, you can't take any advice from others, which is kind of an interesting take on it. But that's kind of the view and the approach that they look at self-sufficiency. Last topic to share with you is about mentors. If you jump with me to page 18. And this is really important. We asked the parents how important they think it is in their child's long-term success to have a mentor or someone who's really interested in them or in their child who's not a parent. Because any action or policy initiatives or programs need to have parents' understanding and approval that it's important in order for them to be behind it and support them. And the fact that you've got 60% of parents who believe that having mentors is important to their child's success is a good indicator. You only have about 14% that say that it's not at all or just very little important. Most parents agree that that's important, even more so than the youth. As you can see, the youth, they're less than half who think that's an important criteria for their success. And then if you go to page 20, we ask the parents how many of them say their child has a mentor. Given it's important, you know it's important, does your child have one? And 59% of parents say, yes, their child does have one. So look at then that first before I go on to the next page. You've got 28% who say, no, child doesn't have one. And another 13 says, I'm not sure. Those numbers aren't actually much different than the teens looking at their own life and the feedback they get. It's pretty accurate. The parent's estimation of what the kids are going to say is pretty accurate, except if you go to page 21, where we ask, okay, who is the mentor? And most of the mentors are coming from the same family circle. In many cases, it's an extended family member. And in other cases, it's a close friend of the family. There are a few mentors who are coming outside that kind of family circle, from school or church or clubs, work, neighbors, business groups, or others. And so again, kind of to the point we mentioned earlier, the circle of influence and the ability to see outside their own circle and the other ways that things happen in the world is again kind of limited in the view of who are the mentors in their lives. And the last thing I'll share, and then I'll open up the questions, is page 22. This is kind of the roles that mentors play. And this was kind of two parts. We asked a variety of different things where mentors might play a role. And then we asked who is the best kind of mentor to provide that help. And there's a recognition that mentors can help with a positive attitude, a positive adult role model, how to handle difficult situations, building confidence. These are all kind of things that had to do with the soft parts of life, the attitudinal, the way, the mental approach, the experiences. There's not a lot of mentoring that parents recognize that can go with more of the hard skills, like schoolwork is a minority of that, believe that it's a role for mentors, or learning skills, or getting a job, or applying to college. Those aren't things that parents are envisioning as roles for mentors. So a broadening of the role of mentors could play could be a good thing. And the only one where the parents see that they aren't the best ones to provide that help is helping their children learn how to be successful in sports. which I thought was kind of fits very much the stereotype view that I think most of us have about mentors and the role that they could play, but the importance of maybe broadening that perspective amongst the parents. But anyway, those are some of the interesting things that we've seen and shared. If I were to summarize it, I'd put it a couple of things. One is that, you know, amongst parents and IGP teens, they really don't see the problem in the same way that many others might see it. They think they're stable, they're actually pretty happier in their life, happier than other teens. And they have different views on what self-sufficiency means. And the problem, the issue is when you don't see there's a problem, there's no need to change. And that's clear as an issue involved here. And the other part is that just the circle of influence. There's a lack of exposure to other world opportunities. There's a bit of self-isolation that may be going on. Yet, one of the positive things that we're seeing is that they see the role of mentors. Parents agree it's a value, and importantly, it's accepted by them. But that view needs to be broadened, not only in the context of going beyond the family circle, but in the context of the skills and types of employment prep and other types of things, the roles that more mentors could play an important role in their life. But anyway, that's just kind of a summary of kind of what we're seeing in this, and be very happy to open it to any questions you might have.
Questions? Yes, Paul?
I should say, too, that the entire survey is online on the Next Generation Freedom Fund website. The whole thing is there for anybody to look at.
I have a question.
Yes, Amy?
You said that this was multi-state survey, so that this is not just a Utah result. Is that right?
So the early phases we talked about was just Utah and Georgia. This study I've been sharing with you is representative across the nation.
Okay.
Further questions? Interesting data presented. We appreciate all of the opportunity of doing that and for your involvement. And thank you for taking the time out of your schedule.
I just had a quick question. I was wondering if you could do an analysis based on the type of assistance or the frequency of assistance. I think if your theory holds about attitudes, that you would see that it wouldn't matter what kind of care you got or how frequently. I'd be concerned if those who got very little had the same attitudes as those who got a lot. It might be some way to look at the data. Have you had a chance to look at it that way?
We have looked at it by every type of assistance, and you're right, there's not a lot of variance in that.
How about
I'm not certain about whether or not frequency of assistance was a variable, and I've not seen any analysis on that on the data that I've looked at.
Thank you.
Yes, Bill?
This might be a longer question, but I'm curious if you have just like a highlight of what you take away from all this. Where do your brains go in terms of what this means for policymakers in this group? Did you hear that?
Paul, I'll let you. I did hear that, but I think that's a question you'd probably want to comment. I can add comments if you'd like, but I'll let you take first whack at that.
Thank you. Again, I just want to reiterate that, you know, there's... It's to me... The IGP kids are just in this bubble. And one of the ways to help them is to break through that bubble and help them see. For instance, if you look at the full survey, you'll see that especially the qualitative part, the phase one, where they're actually interviewing the kids, they all seem to have these big dreams, you know, like, I want to be a lawyer, I want to be an astronaut, I want to be a veterinarian. Not one of them really knows how to accomplish that or seen that. So many, when we were doing the county research, there are kids there who haven't ever even left the county. You know, and no offense, I'm just picking one, but like Millard County, if you've never left Millard County, you know, your worldview is probably pretty limited.
Right. So, for me, that is a big thing. How do you break that bubble that they're in? Introduce them to different worldviews. Introduce them to things they had never even seen before. I'm concerned too about the trauma that the kids face. And as I mentioned, I'm not sure that there's too much cognitive work can be done if their life is full of trauma. And I think what the survey here shows is that in many respects, I don't want to say the trauma is the norm, but they can't see that things could be better. Right? They just kind of accept it. And if we were writing a movie based on this survey research and everything that everybody already knows, you could probably have stories about kids, where the parent could be drug addict, laying on a couch, and still saying to the child, "I love you," right? And in that story, what is that love? I mean, if it's not a verb, if it's just words, that's a different kind of experience than most people would experience with love. I'm talking about specifically in cases where there's trauma in the home. So I would say that you're talking about a culture. You're breaking a culture down. And the only way to do that, I think, is to just introduce a new way of thinking, a new view, a new vision in the lives of these children. Not National Geographic things about animals in Africa. Nothing on TV, but real life experiences. If many of them are saying we're not college people, maybe it's because they can't even imagine what that is, right? They kind of know what high school is, but never having taken to the U of U. I'd rather take them to BYU, but take them to the U of U and see what college life is like. I don't know what they've experienced that will create a strong enough intervention. If the whole idea is still, in terms of state public policy, is to intervene in the life of a child. Dee, any other thoughts there?
You said some of those things so well. I don't want to mess it up, but in my mind, I just sum it that most policies focus on solutions for parents in the form of either training or financial assistance. In my mind, those simply reaffirm an existing situation and don't do much to break. But focusing more on youth and exposing them to broader ideas outside that circle that they've kind of, or bubble they've created for them, I think does present a possibility for breaking the cycle and getting kids to see a broader set of opportunities that are possible. And there's a willingness and acceptance as mentors as a potential tool or angle of entry to be able to help make that happen. That's kind of what I see as the key implications from this.
Yes, I think Dr. Davis had a question, then we go here.
Yeah, just a question on just over a quarter of them, of the teens, said they would not be satisfied with their current situation. What do we know anything, what was different about that smaller group? Was there anything different about these kids that said, no, I would not be satisfied if I were in the same?
Can you hear that, Dave?
Repeat it for me, Paul. You're a little bit closer, or I could hear you a little bit better.
He's just asking for the
for the kids who said they weren't satisfied with their home life?
They would not be satisfied to achieve the same level of attainment as their parents. What's different about those kids?
How are those kids different? Were there any correlatives that would show that there is a difference?
That's an excellent question, and you know, I don't remember that. It's been a few months since we did this. I don't remember looking into that, but that would be a really interesting thing to look into.
I guess one of the things that comes to my mind, because we talk about this, is we tend to focus on one group or the other, and I think it's isolating, or if you just focus on the kids, then you can isolate the parents, and or vice versa. And at least philosophically, I think you both have to nurture the parents. At the same time, if you're supporting and nurturing their children and giving both groups the same levels and kinds of supports and experiences. Because otherwise, you're saying this is bad to the children, the parents. This is bad, and this is good. And you're putting them in a position of basically needing to reject.
Yeah, in terms of public policy, the way that I've tried to frame this dilemma is that for over 60 years, we've basically been very adult-centered in the war on poverty, which really addresses situational poverty, not intergenerational poverty. And so the idea there for 60-plus years has been this trickle-down effect, that if you help the parents, the children will naturally be helped as well. I think where my public policy instincts take me is to flip that script and to focus on the children and let that trickle up. If you had mentors, for instance, that had access to the homes, where it's not just, say, like a school intervention, you know, where it's isolated to the child, but if you had mentors that were able to get into the home, then I think you'd have some of that balance there. You know, the tough part is how do you get an outsider to break through this culture and be trusted in the home. Right? So.
Yes, state your name and identify yourself.
Hi, I'm Dr. Patty Norman, Superintendent of the State Board of Education, and child of intergenerational poverty, and in my dissertation work on intergenerational poverty, situational poverty, and the likes of. So I'm just wondering, I crashed this meeting totally, and so I'll probably have the bar of not being able to come in next time, but I just have three things concerning the research. One, this is just a request of naming, and the request is not to call them IGP teens or IGP parents, but I students experiencing intergenerational poverty, for parents experiencing intergenerational poverty instead of naming and labeling. That just seems to have been what we did in the past and have been not doing in the future, really trying to get them out of it by talking about the situation they're in instead of labeling them as that, and that kind of sticks more in mind. So that's a request of the research and change the label up. Second, there's been a lot of research done in Sunia Luther. I'm not sure if you've done any of the research with Sunia Luther. She's done a lot of comparative analysis between students in poverty and students who are the highest socioeconomic, seeing the strengths and deficits of each of the groups. And within the group, she calls the isolation factor, which has been identified in this study, instead a factor that is connectedness to families. And that sense of connectedness to families is actually a strength of the IGP for youth, that the higher socioeconomic students are not experiencing, and they're not having it because they're moving more, or if they're on a team, then the team is competitive in nature and they're not experiencing true friendship at a greater level, or the ability to rely on a neighbor or rely on a family member. So there's the strengths and the weaknesses that go along with it. So in naming it, they're naming it, I consider isolation, they're naming it connectedness, and that might actually then connect to more research that's being out there in the research community in education. So that might be another link that might connect that. The third is coming from education. I'm looking at the educational factors here, and if you look at that with education, it's at the bottom of the list. And so to me, that's a factor where it looks like your social emotional factors are scoring higher. And so right now where we're in a state where we have suicide at the highest rate, it may be due to expectations, but it may also be to the fact that they have that connection in their homes. So maybe we need to concentrate more on those effort to academic success. Even though they might not be as most important, how do we engage the academic success in a way that finds relevance with the family and the connected factors? Those are the different things. So I apologize for just...
I need not apologize. Thank you for your questions. Any response to those questions, Paul?
Yeah, I can comment. I mean, what you just described is the opposite of everything that we've just shared here. To your first, I honestly, and this is just grumpy old dude, but I'm not sure we can afford to worry about the whole shaming kind of factor anymore. I'm sure if ever this is on our website and they're labeled the way they are, it's not meant to label, but I know that there is this sense of be careful not to isolate the kids, like put them in one room or something where they're labeled that way. But actually, one of the public policies that I could see that might help at the school would be to let these kids maybe have like a half day, call it whatever you want, life lab, where they have mentors. But again, they're going to be treated differently. You know, it's not like they have five or six classes. I don't know what high school is anymore. But, you know, but maybe half of their day is comprised of a different of attention. I think on the isolated versus connectedness, for me, the reason that I would still say it's isolated because it's a culture that we're dealing with. So if they're connected to their parents or their grandparents intergenerationally in these families, the culture is just going to reinforce many of the negatives, not the positives. It's fine that they love their parents or love their grandparents, that's great. But for the purposes of public policy to break the cycle of intergenerational poverty, just to be reinforcing to call it connectedness, even though we all know that connectedness is a great thing. And I forgot your third comment.
The value of education, and it unpacks some of the data on value of education.
Thank you, Paul. In the interest of time, we...
Hey, Bishop. Bishop, just one comment on the earlier question about those that were dissatisfied with if they were to go into a similar situation to their parents. I was able to look that up. It's mostly those kids, it's many of the kids who are living in situations where there's abuse or other fights or other things that are pretty negative going on in the home. Those are more likely to be dissatisfied growing up into a similar situation.
Thank you for that clarification.
I just have a super quick question, Dee. This is Tracy Hoover. Amy asked about the states that were involved. Can you just quickly go through the distribution and the response rates in terms of Utah? I remember seeing the slide about the responses from different geographic areas, but I don't see that here.
So, again, for the first phase, more than half of the, you know, that qualitative in-depth talking to parents and their children, that was more than half of those interviews were done in Utah. But that was in the large number of interviews. But for the national project, the phase two, that was representative of the nation as a whole, and in Utah would have been just a small fraction of that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for that clarification. Thank you, Paul. For all that you have done. I'm interested in the outcomes of the study. Councilwoman Winter Newton, you on the agenda, please?
Yeah, so Tracy asked for me to give some information on things that we've collected over the last 2 months. In Salt Lake County, we've put together our IGP task force, and one of the things we focused on is the highest zip code area
area that has the highest population of intergenerational poverty and families and children who are experiencing that. And so we focus on 84119, which you will have probably. There's a couple of things that we've done as we've tried to gather more information. One is we went and talked to caseworkers at DWS who are specifically helping that population to get their takeaways and what they're hearing. The second thing that we did is we've had just individual focus groups with people who have volunteered to talk to us. We've been able to get a little more in-depth. And the third thing we've done is an online survey through DWS of adults in experiencing the intergenerational poverty that are in that 84119 zip code. So I'll just quickly, do we have time? If I take 10 minutes, is that going to be okay? Okay. So I'll just quickly go through the 11 takeaways we got from the DWS caseworkers. The majority of people in IGP want to successfully escape poverty, which is kind of interesting because what we just saw is opposite of what these caseworkers have observed. Many of them struggle with mental health challenges, and if these could be addressed, they would be more likely to be work ready. Too many youth in the IGP cohort simply don't believe they can break the cycle of poverty. For some customers, if they aren't ready to work but are thrown into a job due to work requirements, it is setting them up to fail. Work readiness varies a lot depending on the individual. The lack of affordable housing is a significant challenge. We all already know that. It is common for customers to turn down jobs or raises due to fear of losing benefits. We need more ability to customize policies in Utah and allow us to be flexible and innovative. Customers working on things such as mental health don't count toward work participation requirements, and these caseworkers wonder if maybe that would be helpful. These work requirements are too prescriptive, and there needs to be better supports for transportation and mental health, which were almost mentioned unanimously. Those were kind of the top two. We made a focus on what are the top two things that you, if you could change, what would it be? And they said transportation and mental health. As far as our online survey through DWS, the survey was sent out to over 800 people. We only had 10 responses. So when I read these, this is not representative at all of what it's not statistically representative.
And how many responses?
10.
Yeah,
only 10. Yep. So this will kind of just give you this just gives a little snippet on the adults in 84119 who are experiencing poverty. So when we asked them things that they would like to see in their community, some of the answers included better health care resources, information on rent assistance and housing, improved parks and recreation spaces, after-school programs for children with transportation so parents can work, increase or frequency of tracks and front runner and expanded routes, change shelters to add more privacy and improve laundry to combat lice and bed bugs. Free mental health counseling, specifically for families dealing with addiction. Expand healthcare resources through Medicaid expansion. Better distribution of information about available resources. When we asked their perceived impact of getting a job or more hours or a raise, the concerns they expressed was over losing SNAP and Medicaid. Some people forget to report changes in income or aren't sure how to do it. There's a lower SNAP allotment after income increases, which makes us struggle more. Would lose all benefits, including medical. Declined a raise at a job because if accepted, they would lose child care services, which they needed for a child with autism. When we asked how changes in benefits after an income change affects their decision making, they said, some said people would look at their costs and then taking a higher paying job to recover costs, they would probably stay with a lower paying job in order to keep their benefits. They're hesitant due to lacking skills for a good paying job. They would accept a raise or work more hours to get out of the system, which is great. They would panic and not function due to fear of losing medical. One said that they worked overtime briefly in 2011, not knowing it would push them above the income limit, and that led to a charge of public assistance fraud when an audit found 8 years later. When we asked how to change the rules to make things easier, we had somebody suggested doing a grace period of 6 months for people to adjust after income increases, and so there was a little more of a weaning off of benefits.
and then raising income limits of programs. When we asked what government rules make it harder and what can be done differently, somebody else mentioned leaning off to systems like SNAP over a few months, give mothers more support while still being able to have fathers in the home, calculating taxes because they don't know how to determine what their take-home pay would be, reduce application paperwork. They said the requirement to fax things in is difficult. They said, why doesn't our system go electronic? Things, when we ask things that get in the way of getting or keeping a job, some of the things mentioned, criminal records, entry-level jobs don't pay enough, don't offer benefits like health insurance, scheduling challenges, lack of reliable transportation and working around the bus schedule, cost of living is too high, mental health issues, hard to find mental health professionals who accept Medicaid, child care for kids who are sick so the parent doesn't miss work, health issues, conviction of public assistance fraud in the past. That must have been the same person.
Yeah.
And then one thing that if they wish that we could change for their family right now, they said more affordable housing, a home of my own, a steady job, better access to medicine, more financial assistance to help pay for medication, and this was interesting, the ability to pay back the state for public assistance. Isn't that interesting that somebody said that? I think the most helpful things that we've done are the 5 interviews that we did with women who were experiencing intergenerational poverty as a child and received public assistance and are now dealing with the same issues. And as we interviewed these 5 women, we actually got them through the Circles program. So you guys are probably all familiar with Circles, which we've come to love these people, and they've been great. They've done panels for Nick and I as we've gone to some of their meetings so that we can talk to them and find these people so that we can interview them, and so we spent quite a bit of time. So just a few things that were interesting in this as we talked to them. Obviously, affordable housing we hear is a big issue. But one of the things that they all mentioned is that there's an application fee of $30 to $50 per adult every time you apply to rent somewhere. And they talked about, you know, this is draining us. It's really problematic how they're even worried about giving so much of their personal information to who knows who as they apply for these different places to rent. Someone mentioned that she wished she would have put a certain amount of money, or that somebody would have helped her put $20 a month for savings away so that it would incentivize her to have housing deposits. She says she has to keep going into DWS to fill out paperwork. It takes time away from work. Office hours are only 8 to 5. Sometimes she's waiting on hold if she calls during an entire lunch break and can't get through. CAP is also only business hours. Another one said, man, when I hear these stories, it makes me so sad. They're talking about how hard it is to find an affordable apartment, and the one that they finally were able to qualify for because of, you know, having evictions or other things on the record. The roof leaks, there's sewage that comes up in the shower, the walls are starting to separate and holes coming in, and she's worried about her aging father who has pneumonia. They all talked about having evictions on your credit or the requirement to make 3 times the amount of rent is problematic if they look for affordable housing. And all of them have talked about the cliff effect and how it's made them hard to recover because benefits are cut immediately and they don't have that gradual ability to lean off of public assistance. One woman talked about how her son passed away suddenly. He was 13 years old. And because she was one less person for getting government assistance, they removed her. She got booted off the program. She made $20 too much that month. And she said, so she didn't get the Medicaid and the medication that she needed for her depression. And she said it's kind of put her back. She also complained about a lack of communication with government entities, which I thought was interesting. Somebody said they live in an apartment through Rogue Homes Housing Agency. Their hours are really inconvenient, and they will only pay 3 application fees. The biggest barrier to finding a job is transportation. She has no car, no money. She's not getting financial help, so she doesn't have a caseworker. D- DWS will give her a bus pass for the first month once she finds a job, but she can't get to the interviews prior to getting the job. She's on food stamps, has her first month's rent and a deposit covered, wishes the shelter wouldn't have pushed her out so fast. The other thing that we heard, that we asked them when we were at one of the circles meetings, what are things, programs that have helped? And the answer from this little panel was the circle program. They love the camaraderie and that someone believes in them. And that's in fact the mentoring, I think, that we talked about earlier. Head Start is great. The Children's Center and CAP are specific things mentioned. When we asked things that didn't help, they mentioned rapid rehousing. They said you get in before you have a job, it doesn't work, you get evicted, and now you have an eviction on your record. They said that road home floors were too dirty for babies. They didn't know what their household limits were. They have a lot of complaints about landlords who don't have fair practices and that have discriminated because of them being a student or other things. And then my own observation, as we talked with these women, I would ask them, hey, are you okay if I ask you this personal question? And I would ask them, tell me about your childhood. Did you have childhood trauma? Did you have witness abuse or, you know, drug use in your home? Were you? And every single one of these women said yes. They have high ACEs scores. They are dealing with childhood trauma, which to me tells us we have a bigger problem. We've got to get to the underlying root causes here in a lot of these cases, which goes back to, you know, how we help our kids. And then all of them said that this is real and a barrier for them and improving their employment situation. So one of the things that one of our takeaways from this is we're actually putting together a housing roundtable. And we want to have a panel of these women to be able to talk about housing and the barriers they're facing. We're going to do it during one of our circles meetings on May 23rd and invite people from the Apartment Association, apartment owners, legislators, people who can listen to this to maybe get a little more grassroots view of what's really happening and barriers that some of these women in this population are facing. Sorry, I took 11 minutes.
I had a quick comment. So, really good feedback for our department. One thing that I think would be helpful, just I don't know moving forward how much you're going to work with the women, but just as an aside, and Nick would be familiar with this probably too, so he would know who to connect with, but just thinking of all of the different responses that they have around these public assistance programs, and not that this is like what we're trying to solve, but just as a representative of DWS, I just feel inclined to say it, that I think what we find a lot, because a lot of the comments that they're saying, like the Medicaid one, that woman should not have been ineligible. Like, she should have gone to a transitional Medicaid program for 6 to 12 months. So what we see a lot with people when they have these situational changes, sometimes, you know, and this is government at its finest, right? We send paperwork that says, hey, you've got this change, and really nothing should have to happen, but sometimes there is a requirement just to report back and verify that change. And when they don't, that's when their benefits stop, which is, you know, in this situation, not a good scenario. But they correlate that with the change and not with the fact that they didn't verify the change. And so it is problematic. If we were all federal employees and we could rewrite these policies, we probably would, right? But so I just think that if there's anything that we can do as a department to interface with these folks to help, because education is a big thing. I mean, our employees take a year to learn these jobs and these policies, and so it does not surprise me when we have complicated issues. But at the same time, I feel like it's important. That's a good, you know, medication, stability in their, you know, food security, those kinds of things are important. So we want to make sure if, as you're doing this, you want to include us all moving forward, we'd be happy to have our staff be included. And I know that's not the basis of your research, but we're happy to kind of help remedy some of those.
Yeah, and we understand that, you know, and you work through DWS, so they're telling some of these sources, like, okay, well,
yeah, I'm
not
sure
we get that. It's their perception, right? One of the things that might be interesting for DWS to explore, though, have you guys thought about doing a 4-day work week or extended hours or something? Because these men, when I hear their stories of trying to...
We have a 4-day work week.
You do?
The legislature took it away. We did have a 4-day work
right.
week.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm happy to do it again. Our staff would celebrate that. It was great. But no, I was thinking that in my mind as well. So
yeah,
that's good feedback. Maybe we can sit down with Dale at some point, Nick, if you want to do that, and just go through this. I think it'd be helpful.
That's great. Thanks.
My name is Denise Adams. I'm here. the Davis County Community Action Program. We run the service program in Davis County. We have, we're on our fourth year. We've had a lot of success with it. We've heard the same problems to DWS this and that, and we found that it is a culture of poverty, that these people were listening to other people. Oh, if I do this, I'll lose this. It wasn't actually an experience. It was a hearsay. So we brought Department of Workforce Services in to our meeting, and they were able to address things and also to give them solutions on how to solve these problems. So that's another thing I always have to take into consideration. People, the culture of poverty, is poverty and the same thoughts. It's helping them break out of that.
Thank you for that observation. We, any questions? Let's go then to Mary Beth.
Mary Beth is on the phone. And this is just an effort. This is Tracy, Mary Beth. This is having Paul and Councilwoman Winter Newton and Mary Beth present is to kind of bring into the work the perceptions of the families experiencing intergenerational poverty. So Mary Beth has another perspective, and it is 11:30. So Mary Beth, that's my way of saying we're running tight on time.
Yes, are you on the line?
I am. It sounds like it's my turn.
Yes, please.
Okay, I want to make sure I could be heard. First, I want to just preface this by saying that this work from the Social Research Institute is something that DWS has been sponsoring for in May. It'll be 20 years for me, and I know there were people before me. And that's to their credit, that this idea of better understanding customers and their experience with the programs, their barriers, their strengths, has been something that the agency has put a lot of effort into over the years, and I think has designed programs based on that. I don't want to try to summarize everything we have over 20 years, but I think that there's just a couple of points that might want to think about moving forward. We have a lot of data that could be used to kind of compare with what we've heard today to see how Utah specifically might have maybe a little bit different perspective on some of the questions that were asked. We have very similar data that we could use some comparisons. They're very complex issues, and I think learning more about some of the challenges that people face and their backgrounds, as Lana and Councilwoman Winder Newton talked about, the ACEs and the two-generation approach, these adults that we have on public benefits now were all children at one point. And when we've looked at the childhood experiences of these individuals compared to the general population in Utah, we see that there's significant issues that have probably led to them needing some of the supports that they need. So that two-generation approach, I think, is something that we really have to keep in mind, because this idea that these parents are either not interested in bettering the lives of their children or doing better for themselves is something that I think some of our data would challenge to a certain degree. In fact, part of DWS's work right now is helping people understand that it's a good thing to be able to come in and be able to recognize that you're at a point where you could use a hand up. And we have so many people who are eligible for benefits who never come in, and so their family just languishes without that kind of support. For some people, that idea of self-sufficiency equal being on benefits, the way that's interpreted is that stability. If I'm in a low-income job or in a job that has variable hours and I don't know whether I'm going to be able to pay my rent each month, I'm going to look at what's going to keep my family most stable. And so it's looking at the mentality behind the action versus just the actions themselves. Again, a little bit on the whole idea of parenting. Parents are the primary educators of their children, and they want to be able to have that role. And so thinking about policy or practices that look at partnering with parents versus replacing parents as being in that role with their children. Again, if these parents are people that grew up with ACEs themselves and they're really struggling, then to be able to partner with them and help them be able to do what it seems they really do want to do with their children, which is to give them a better life. That idea of breaking the bubble is not, again, replacing the parent, but helping them maybe develop some of the skills that their adverse childhood experiences or their ACEs made it difficult for them to learn as they were growing up. So it sets up the whole family for a larger piece of success. educational goal. We have a lot of data where we've asked parents specifically about their goals for education for their children. And by and large, they very much are seeking to improve the outcomes and the educational opportunities for their children. But I think that there's a very big difference between not wanting to change and not having any idea on how to make change. And so working with parents, again, as partners, to be able to help them imagine and walk a pathway for a future for their children is something that the families would be very open to. In doing the WIOA studies, where we've actually been working with more WIOA customers these days, and I've had several of them just talk about the fact that they're going back to school now because they worked all of their children's childhood to put their children through school. And so now it's their opportunity to go back and get the further education that they want now that their children are doing better and moving forward. So I think this is kind of an overview. There's a lot more information. I would love to be able to look at the questions from the study that was presented and see how we can compare that with the thousands of Utahns that we've interviewed and see how that might maybe look a little different from Utah context. Those are some thoughts.
Thank you, Mary Beth. Questions? Observations? Thank you all for sharing the experiences relative to families and the studies that take the place. In the interest of time, Doug, go forward, and we will probably eliminate the last time. So go ahead and take what time you need. We've got about 20 minutes left.
We'll still be very quick. So we wanted to do, the committee wanted to do this very important survey because we needed to see what was going on across our state in order to make decisions so that we're not just creating ideas where the legislature should do this or that, and we go out to the state and they say, what do you think we're doing? We're already doing it. There is a handout that wasn't called to your attention on the page 7, titled Building Partnerships to Create a Common from Utah, so you can see the summary of the data, which was all very positive data. And we were excited that 624 surveys were completed. Really, across the state, so we've got a picture, you can see the data there. And we're really interested between what Mary Beth has shared and listed here, if there are questions or thoughts regarding the data statewide.
I'm just going to jump in super quick. Thank you for pointing out what's in the packets. If you're an advisory member, just don't walk off with your binders. We're going to bring them back every meeting. I forgot to say that. So thank you for pointing out.
That's stealing. So let me just point out in the middle of the page here that 84% say yes, they are implementing a trauma-informed approach in their agency organization. whether the agency needed to, 70% say yes, we agree. They've already taken steps, is about 59%. So we know there's a gap between the agencies across the state saying yes, we've already got it, and yes, we think it's important. Would they be interested in participating? Absolutely. And you know, I'd point out too, there's a big conference downtown this week. We had over 200 clinicians representing private practice and agencies yesterday attending a presentation on how to become trauma-informed. We know that there's a lot of interest there. We also know that there's a lot of great work being done across the state. A lot of the work is being done in singular trainings, which is not sufficient to really become trauma-informed. I think another big concern that we keep hearing is people that are trauma-informed saying, well, that's all good and well, but you tell us to refer for evidence-based care, and where are the trained therapists? So we're also really looking at how do we create a sustainable trauma-informed state. What we don't want to do as a committee, and it's been much of our discussion, is to give a lot of suggestions, spend a lot of money, and 5 years from now we're sitting on the table going, what happened to all that great trauma-informed work? And as a result of that, our committee is really wanting to further study this and bring back information, hopefully for the August meeting, it'll be more specific. But we would like to hear if any of you have ideas about the data or things that should be happening for a statewide approach. Welcome that information.
Nice to meet you. I've heard a lot about your process. I do a lot of work with Brooks Keeshan. You probably know Brooks of the Karen Jones University. And he's doing a lot of work to train trauma-informed therapists across the state. There is also a process model that, again, to make one of these projects you're talking about, but connecting to primary care for children to do to a brief trauma screener and then connect to evidence-based care for those that have that need. So that's ongoing work that's really exciting. We're piloting it in my clinic. It's very useful in my clinic. So, but Brooks has done a lot. There's
okay, we'll keep studying the data and we'll bring back observations and recommendations.
Thank you very much. Would you have a minute or two, Tracy, why don't we just get the highlights of the...
Sure. That's very quick. I'll just give the update on the follow-up items and go through that pretty quickly, focusing on the county grants and the Stampede pilot. And TJ Signaler from our staff is on the phone, and he's the staff member that's really overseeing all the county grants. So as a reminder, there's six counties that are currently receiving funding due to the legislature's appropriation of money last legislative session. They are implementing their county plans that they developed in 2016 and 17. And through that work, we have their first quarterly report, so just an update on that. That only covered the data from November 30th, September 1st to December 31st, and there's not much data to report there because they were implementing their plans, getting people hired. Their next quarterly report is due at the end of this month, which will reflect data up through March. We have also extended their contracts through the end of December because of the ramping up period that it took. The challenges that they're having are identifying families that are experiencing intergenerational poverty, and we've provided them with some resources to help them do that. This is an ongoing challenge due to privacy restrictions. We cannot give out the names. So we've been helping the counties identify those families through other avenues. The good news is that the legislature, if you didn't already know this, appropriated additional funding for another round of grants, and we had our kind of overview meeting yesterday for counties to apply. So any county that is not currently receiving funding but has a plan that aligns with the commission's 5- and 10-year goals that they want to implement has the ability to apply for this new funding. So that grant is currently out for those of you who might be interested in getting the word out to your counties if they have a plan that aligns with the 5- and 10-year goals. So that's kind of the high-level update. The county, IGP County Subcommittee, expressed concerns about child care. So DWS, the Office of Child Care, hosted a webinar on what resources are available to child care. It's similar to other programs. There's a lot of misinformation out there, so to the extent that we can clarify it with our counties, we did host that webinar and happy to host any additional webinars. A quick update on the Stampede pilot. The commission instructed the agencies to develop a pilot to try to determine the best approach to coordinating services for families experiencing intergenerational poverty and try to address this issue of not being able to share information. So we've been working as a committee across multiple agencies. We established a consent form that, in coordination with the Stampede IGP County grant, this pilot is taking shape. and reached out to families who are experiencing intergenerational poverty with children between the ages of 3 and 5. San Pete has a high quality preschool program, available to accept children covered by the IGP scholarship. So this was an effort to kind of connect those families with young children to the resources that are available in early childhood to get them ready for kindergarten. So DWS did a mailing to all these families, followed up with phone calls, had waivers signed, similar to the response rate for the survey that Councilwoman Linder Newton mentioned. The response rate was pretty low. We got 8 consent forms, and that information has been shared across all of our agencies to see where coordination can take place. San Pete School District, through their grant, also hired an early childhood liaison who is kind of the centralized individual who is reaching out to all of the families that signed the consent and trying to provide that wraparound resource for the family. So that's the direction that we're going heading in for the San Pete pilot and trying to really troubleshoot how to deal with that coordination issue at the multi-governmental agency level. So those are the two updates on those follow-up items on the county grant and the county pilot.
Questions? I'll get to those items. Are there items of business that any of you would like to report? Yes.
Yes. Can I just, Casey, when you mentioned that if we all could revamp the federal guidelines on, you know, public assistance, boy, we'd have some great people. Have we thought about having maybe a subcommittee where we have people who can put their heads together and really figure out what does that look like and let's go after it? I mean, I'm happy to have something like that. I know Nick's talking about. I don't know if that's something that would be appropriate to fall under this body, but let's try to make. I mean, let's apply for some waivers or try to do some things on the federal level there.
Need to identify those items that require a waiver so we can do independently without those.
I'm happy to talk with you.
Okay.
If you want, I'll try. Yeah, let's talk about it. Yeah.
Okay. Any further observations, questions, items of business? Anything for the good of the process? We have not a date set for the next meeting yet, do we?
We do. It's a joint advisory commission meeting, and it's in August. I'll just go back to the binders really quick. If you want notifications about all the subcommittees, the Welfare Reform Commission meeting, the IGP Advisory Committee meeting, I will. Is there a form in the binders to fill out?
I have one here. You know that I can email everyone.
There's a form that we're asking people to sign up for, so that we can give. Ensure that everybody needs to know about the meeting they have on. So this meeting in August, y'all have the right date for the meeting. And apologize in advance that on rare occasion the meetings can get changed. So I'm just going to say the date.
The meeting dates are actually on the inside of the binder.
So this, it looks like it's. Thank you. August 13th. It's August 13th. Yep. And that's a joint commission and committee meeting, August 13th. So we're hoping that by having these binders, you have the information, you can get the information on your calendars, and on a regular, every meeting, we will collect the binders, and then at the next meeting, bring back all the meeting materials printed and in the binder. So that's why we'd like for you to leave your binders behind if you're an advisory committee member. We'll make sure that you get copies of all the meeting materials if you want to have them in addition to what's contained
in the Thank you for your attendance. Look forward to seeing you then in August. You probably need to put on your swim fins if you get home. But you live in the desert, but you don't want to know that.